My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which is about words. And this week it's about elementary medical words, as might be bandied about between the doctor and the nurse. For 2 marks, what in layman's language is the meaning of the following? We begin with Frank Muir. Frank, you've got an embolism. E-M-B-O-L-I-S-M.
Embolism was a sort of early 16th century heresy, wasn't it? Embolism, Dieter Embol, in the Protestant Swiss valleys. He reckoned that that people should worship standing on their head as a sort of higher form of, and
that might have done some medical damage.
Well, no, it didn't. But all the other sects, and there were a lot of heretical sects around the time, and the Roman Catholic Church just dismissed them as a lot of clots. And then the medical people latched onto this, and embolism is a blood clot, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it isn't itself blood, but
well, it's a blockage.
That's right. That'll do. embolism medically is a obstruction of an artery or a vein by globules of air or fat, if you're unlucky, which can cause all sorts of things like paralysis and possibly heart attack. It means, from the Greek, a stopper or a plug. But taking Frank back into the early days, it also meant, and that may have been what he was hinting at, the bit where the calendar went all wrong and you had to fit in 2 or 3 extra days in order to get it right again. And that was an embolism too. It's just the opposite, Frank, of what one of your favourite subjects, which is give us back our 11 days.
It never occurred to me, actually, I must be honest. So I can't claim a bonus mark, the calendar bit.
Get your 2. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, and yours is a placebo. P-L-A-C-E-B-O, placebo.
Oh, you hear much more about these than you did in my young days. I think, with neurotic patients in particular, the doctor gives them a nice pink pill.
Yes.
Or a purple bottle of purple medicine, which is in fact valueless. It's just coloured water or a coloured pill. It's a tranquilizer, really.
Yes, I think that'll do.
Years ago, I was in Moscow for 5 days, and the only sort of word I learned, which is a very useful one, is spasibo.
Ah.
Which means sort of thank you and everything, it's placebo. And I got it wrong, and the whole of my 5 days I said placebo. Didn't mean anything to either of us.
What did you get, an enema or something? Now it's Dennis Norden's turn. Dennis, yours is a hematoma, H-A-E-M-A-T-O-M-A, hematoma.
Hematoma is the condition with which an Italian wife describes why her husband isn't at work. I really don't know.
Would you?
But is hema, I believe, has something to do with blood,
that's
generally.
Right. Yep.
But what a toma is, it isn't an atom of blood, is it?
No.
It's a swelling, isn't it?
Swelling of blood.
Yes, if you make your stay-at-home husband a bit more actively disliking his wife, he might produce this on her corpus.
Oh.
Blood blister?
Well, no, not quite.
Love bite.
1.5. It's, in simple language, it is a bruise. And that is, it's a quantity of blood effused into the tissue round the blood vessels, the connective tissue, and the medical word is hematoma. 1.5. Dennis Powell, yours. Tachycardia, T-A-C-H-Y-C-A-R-D-I-A, tachycardia.
Well, cardia means heart in Greek.
Yes.
Ancient or modern.
Sticky heart.
Sticky heart, or not sticky, rapid heart.
An accelerated
moving
heart.
Rapidly. In fact, what I believe was once known as palpitations.
Yes, I'm going to do. Two marks. It's an increase in the rate of the heartbeat. Can be occasioned in various ways by taking too much exercise, by a fever. It can be a thing which goes on for quite a long time, and then it becomes a disease. And it can be, I suppose, produced by emotion, if you're unlucky. So it simply means your heart is beating much more rapidly than it normally should.
I get that, don't you?
Well, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations that you've been given for the last round, and yours, Frank Muir, is the unspeakable in full pursuit of the uneatable, and yours, Dennis, is a storm in a teacup. Well, this next round is a round of vocational vernacular, and for two marks, I want members of the teams to hazard a guess at the trade or profession or calling to whose special language the following words or phrases belong. Frank Muir starts again, and yours are a half bat, a bull nose, a dog leg, and a squint.
Half bat's a brick.
That's right, that's what I wanted.
I built a brick wall.
That's what I hoped you'd do.
A very small brick wall.
Yes.
And it's a question of whether I had half bats or wire cuts.
That's right.
Wire cuts are bricked.
Yeah. That's it, and so are half headers. Yes, you're right. This is the trade or art of bricklaying. These are all different sizes or shapes or manufacturers of brick. Two marks. And Scott James now. A web strainer, a cabriole hammer, a regulator, and feathers.
A cabriole, of course, is a kind of leg you get on a chair.
Yes, or the chair itself.
Is it carpentering?
Well, after you've had your carpentry, it's rather hard to sit on. What happens next?
Ah, cane. You've got to upholster.
That's right.
It's all to do with... the web, yes, of course, the upholstery web. Upholstery, Jack.
Absolutely right. Two marks. The first three, the web strainer, the cabriole hammer, and the regulator, I'm told, are tools that you use in the act of stuffing the stuffed bit of your furniture. And feathers, of course, are what you could stuff it with if you like to. There are plenty of other alternatives. Dennis Norden's turn, and your lot is this. Capture ratio, a dropout, a hum loop, and a flapping baffle.
Well, the only two words that bring any tiny tinkle, hum loop, and a baffle, is to do with loudspeakers and things,
yes.
Isn't it? So it's to do with sound. The sound engineers would use all.
Absolutely right, Dennis. This is sound or hi-fi engineering, and the terms are so technical that even if I knew what the answer was, I couldn't begin to describe them to you. So I give two marks rapidly to Dennis for an absolutely accurate answer.
The two hi-fi words that I like are woofers and tweeters.
Yes.
Which I always think, you know, those sort of rather posh restaurants which the loos are never labelled ladies and gentlemen. They're always sort of senors and senoritas and things like that. I always think that they should label one woofers and one...
Now to this foul. Saddle grafting, a Geneva double curtain, the Lentz-Moser system, and the noble rottenness.
Noble what?
Rottenness.
Rottenness?
I'll put it into French, which might possibly help you. It's called pourriture noble. That might help. You were benefiting from it about a quarter of an hour ago.
Oh, vineyards with wine growing.
Yes.
Vineyard culture, viniculture.
Yes, I helped you an awful lot, but
no.
Could you Could you hazard a guess of what they mean when they say noble rottenness? Frank might help.
This is a quotation, isn't it? Noble rottenness. It's when the grape has...
It comes very sweet, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's when it's left to rot. Mm. Is it white wine, I think, isn't it?
Mostly white wine, yes.
German, I think.
German
wine. Yeah.
Sounds like the opposite of noblesse oblige.
Yes, you're thinking about Trockenberger Ausle, so with hock. Yes. They leave the grapes on the vine.
And they're absolutely dry.
And they're dry.
And very sweet.
Nearly rotten and very sweet. Mm. Good. Well, these are all to do with what's called either viticulture or viniculture, which is the growing of grapes for the greater glory of wine producing. We owe a lot to a lot of people who are expert on these things.
It's the hick you have to hike into the hock.
Well, now we have a round of incomplete quotations and two marks again. I just want to know the line of poetry that follows on the one I'm going to quote, and I'd like to have the author's name too. Frank Muir, and know then thyself, presume not God to scan.
To know thyself, the proper study of mankind is man.
Quite right. Author?
Alexander Pope.
Yes.
Essay on Man.
Quite right. Two marks straight away. Well done. Anne Scott James, the man recovered of the bite.
Oh, this is Goldsmith, isn't it?
Yes.
Poem on a mad dog.
Yes, and the next line.
Now, can you tell me what that one was again? I forgot. What was the line you gave?
The man recovered of the bite.
The dog it was that died.
Absolutely right. Goldsmith's elegy on the death of a mad dog. The dog, to gain some private ends, went mad and bit the man. And it was the man who survived and the dog that died. Two marks. Dennis Norden. But the she-bear thus accosted rends the peasant tooth and nail.
For the female of the species is more deadly than the male.
whether we should get past the Sex Discrimination Act or not, I don't know. Author?
Kipling.
Kipling in The Female of the Species. Two marks. Dennis Powell. And then, from hour to hour, we rot and rot.
Did we? Rot? I don't think I have the faintest idea.
Can't help you, dear.
No, you can, dear.
Go to Arden.
Forest of Arden?
Mm-hmm.
Forest of Arden?
Easy.
It's Shakespeare.
Yes, quite.
It's Shakespeare.
Yes.
It's As You Like It.
Yes.
It's As You Like
I'll give you a bit more of a mark if you can think who might possibly have said these things.
Jaques.
Good for you.
Melancholy
Jaques.
1.5, a lot of help there. It, in fact, is Jaques in As You Like It, Shakespeare, quoting, or so he says, Touchstone, whom he'd found mouthing out these phrases in the middle of the forest, and he's telling the Duke what Touchstone had been saying. 1.5. Well, now we come to the last round, and Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, if you remember, your quotation is The Unspeakable in Full Pursuit of the Uneatable, which is Oscar Wilde, his remark on hunting.
Well, I thought it was Oscar Wilde, and I was disillusioned last weekend when I was in Dublin. It poured with rain all the time, and I was wearing suede shoes, and they got soaked through. And it's ridiculous to wear suede shoes in Dublin as it is to wear flippers to an evening of Scottish dancing. But I was sitting in my hotel in the Royal Hibernian, has a sort of lounge with a roaring peat fire. And I had my feet up, and my suedes were steaming. And the night porter, said to me, are you going to the hunting tomorrow? And I said, The Unspeakable in Full Pursuit of the Uneatable, as Oscar Wilde said. And he said, Oscar Wilde didn't say that. It was me grandfather, Patrick. So I said, really? And he said, yes. And it appears that a lot of Oscar Wilde's famous play titles and phrases, like Lady Windermere's Fan, The Importance of Being Earnest, didn't originate with Oscar Wilde at all, but with the night porter of the Royal Hibernian Hotel, grandfather Patrick. It appears that, I can't do the Irish accent, so it has to be reported speech, but the around about 1860, the young Oscar Wilde went to stay at a country house where the night porter's grandfather was the sort of estate man. It was Lord Bale's estate in the Wicklow Hills. And it was quite a small party. There was Lady Winifred, the daughter, who was a young and pert 12-year-old. And there was a nephew, the Honourable Edward, who was a gay young spark of 24. A rather sort of lecherous young man whose nickname was Sparky. And there was a distant cousin, a most beautiful but voluptuous girl called the Honourable Henrietta, who was known as Etta. Lady Winifred, this tiny little tot of 12, who was very disorderly, and she spent the afternoon throwing cream buns up at the ceiling of the dining room. So they'd stick there. Then during the dinner party at the evening, they'd dry out and descend on the heads of the guests. And she was chastised by his lordship and her ladyship, and she ran to the night porter's grandfather, Patrick, and he comforted her. And Oscar Wilde saw that and said, it's funny that she seems to like you. And he said, that is, the grandfather of the night porter said, ah, she's a little devil to the other people, but, you know, Lady Wintermere is fun. So he got out his notebook, Oscar Wilde, and wrote, that's a good phrase, I might be able to use that. Lady Windermere's fun. And next day, they were breaking in a pony to fit the trap. And when the pony had finally allowed all the bridle and the leather work to be put on them, he stood there so proudly. And Oscar Wilde said, the pony really seems to enjoy all that. And the night porter's grandfather, Patrick, said, oh, yes, yes. It's the importance of being harnessed. So, Oscar Wilde took out his notebook and said, that's a good phrase, I'll be able to make use of that. And that late afternoon of the same day, he got this phrase, the unspeakable in full pursuit of the uneatable, from the night porter's grandfather, Patrick. It happened because they were strolling together, because they then got on quite well, near the shrubbery. And it's a vast shrubbery at Lord Bale's estate. And all the afternoon they'd seen nothing of Sparky, who was leering at the Honourable Henrietta all afternoon. And her, every time he looked at her cheek mantled. And every time he gazed at her in profile, because she had a figure which would warp a 10-inch teak plank at 50 paces, steam came out of his, Sparky's, ears. And they seemed to have disappeared from the house party. And suddenly there was a tremendous noise in the shrubbery. There was a hunting horn. Went, and there was a sort of female giggles, and then the voice of Sparky saying, "View, hello! I see the little beast! I'll get her!" And Oscar Wilde said, "What's going on? Are they fox hunting?" And the night porter's grandfather, Patrick, said, "Well, sir, yes, yes, it is a hunt, sir. It is that. But it's not a fox hunt, sir. There's no fox, sir. And there's no horses, and there's no hounds." So Oscar Wilde said, well, what sort of hunt is it? And he said, well, sir, let me put it this way. 'Tis the Hun Sparky Bale in full pursuit of the Hun Etta Bale.
Well, after those terrible goings-on in the 19th century, we turn to Dennis Norton. If you remember, his quotation was, a storm in a teacup.
Well, of all the varieties of bores in this world, the ones that I find the most bone-aching are those enthusiasts who, when it's a clear night, drag you outside and insist on showing you where all the stars and the constellations are and exactly what each one's name is. Now, it just so happens that I'm one of those people who is, A, physically incapable of distinguishing one star from another, B, doesn't really feel any need to distinguish one star from another, and C, as a result of trying to distinguish one star from another, had my face kicked in by a professional astronomer. Having said which, I think C is the one that needs some elaborating on. It so happened that during that very hot summer we had, whilst I was at a dinner party given at by one of our better-off neighbours, it turned out to be a really draggy affair, one of those gatherings where everyone was called Tristram or Imogen or Cressida. And the women all had clanking bracelets all the way up each arm, and their husbands were dressed to a man in those kind of casual shirts that looked like leftover wallpaper. And all that the lady I sat next to at dinner talked about right through the meal was worming her dog. Well, after dinner, we all gathered in one hot room. There must have been about 80 of us. The noise level rose to about force 8. The temperature soared to a point where even the ice cubes felt warm. So I unobtrusively slipped out into the garden. And I suddenly became conscious of a figure in the middle of the lawn. It was a rather attractive lady standing stock still, her face in the air, her mouth half open, and nostrils quivering. Now, as that's a posture familiar to anyone who's recently tried to give up smoking, I hastened over to her, and just as I was about to offer a life-saving peppermint, she uttered the dreaded opening line. "Have you noticed how clear the stars are tonight?" My heart sank. The mere mention of that question, and I am always immediately overwhelmed with a desire for thick fog. Thrusting a finger upwards, she said, "Look, that's Ursa Major." Rather as though she was referring to Frank Sinatra. "You realize," she said, "the light from Ursa Major takes 4 billion years to arrive here." I said, "It must come by post." You know, making a sort of feeble effort to change the subject. But there is absolutely no deflecting these suburban Galileos. She said, "Shall I show you how to find Cassiopeia?" I said, "No, thanks." She said, "All you have to do is locate the plough." I said, "Well, I learnt that at Scouts." I said, it's up around there, isn't it?" I made a vague gesture that, astronomically speaking, encompassed about 38 million square light years. I'm sorry, I said, I really can't go further than that, because if I stand looking upwards for any length of time, I get a funny kind of dizzy spell. And she said, "Well, never mind." She said, "Lie on the ground." I said, "I beg your pardon." She said, "Well, my husband is a professional astronomer, and that's what we always do when he can't get to his telescopic apparatus." "Like this," she said. And with which, she got down on the grass and stretched out full length on her back. So, like a nana, I also lay down on the grass about 3 feet away. And as we both gazed outwards, she said, "Now look, just beyond the point of the plough, do you see it?" And I said, "Yes. Yes, I do. It's sort of blinking on and off, and it's moving towards Hounslow." And she said, "No, no." She said, that's the last Alitalia from Milan. She said, "Look, just fix yourself about 3 degrees south of the plough. Do you see it now?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I can see it distinctly." I said, "Well, you must be a bit nearer to it than I." She said, "Well, look, you come over here and lie on top of me." I said, "Do what?" She said, "I've got it exactly." She said, "If you stretch out above me, You could just let your eyes follow the direction of my pointing finger. Well, by that time, it got to the point when I just wasn't going to let myself be beat by some small overhead dot of light. So I did just that. And it was while I was lying full length on my back on top of this lady, straining my eyes into the night, that all of a sudden I heard a male voice say, "What exactly is this?" And I said, "Well, if you're looking in the right direction, it's Cassiopeia." Do you know that chap's boot altered the shape of my whole facial structure? I still can't understand to this day why a professional astronomer should feel the need to wear steel-tipped toe caps. But if I ever am nowadays asked why it is that one of my cheekbones is less prominent than the other, I always say, just a storm in a teacup. But if I'm then pressed to elaborate in further detail, I go on to say, astronomer toe cap.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, and we have an unusual result for the whole contest, which is a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shryan.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.